Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, December 7th, 2006, and this is the first in a four-part series dealing with ultimate survival. Now, I've done four-part series before, and I'll give you, because many people are new to this show, I'll give you the dates of those shows. On this was May 18th to June 1st. Let's see. It was May 18th, May 5th, May 25th, June 1st, and June 8th of 2006. I did a series called The Issues of Extrasolar System Disasters, The Psychology of Planet X. And that was a very subtle and important set of radio broadcasts. Those are archived, of course, in the standard locations on the network and also on my webpage. If you want to go to the webpage and find those, jmccsci.com is the abbreviated form, www.jmccsci.com, and of course on the network also archived. Now, on the last four shows of December last year, 2005, the December 8th, 15th, the 22nd, and the 29th, that's the last four shows of 2005, I did a four-part series on Planet X, on the science of Planet X, etc. So those are two earlier four-part series that I've done, and now this show, very timely, and a very interesting different twist on the topic of these earthwide calamities that come along upon our planet every, sometimes they don't occur very often. It just turns out that we are coming out of one that happened a number of thousands of years ago, and I don't put dates on issues like this. I'm not a person that puts dates on things. You always run into severe problems when you do that, but suffice it to say that these issues, these earthwide catastrophes, occurred a number of thousands of years ago, and these have happened many times in Earth's history. So this is the way the world, the way the solar system works. And so I'm going to talk about survival and what people in the past did and what is available for you today to be prepared. Not that everybody would survive, not that everybody is a survivor. I know people that don't even want to have anything to do with it. They would rather just die in the first wave and be done with it. But be that as it may, the information is out there, and sometimes these disasters are not all that severe, and so just a bit of preparation would help. Ultimately, the preparations are the same, no matter whether it's a man-made disaster or a natural catastrophe of some kind. Remember, we have almost how many active volcanoes on this planet? Large ones which could alter the Earth's climate over a 5 to 10 year period. And once again, you might be your only source of clean, fresh water and fresh food. And that's basically there are steps in preparing and being ready. And sometimes you may not be where all your preparations are. I know people that have made tremendous preparations. But what if you're on vacation, or you just happen to be away, or 10 miles away? Sometimes with these disasters, going just 10 miles could be impossible. So all of your preparations will be over there, and you can't get to them. So survival tactics, what would you do? How would you maintain? And what are the minimal things that you need to survive in case of minor or major ultimate catastrophes. So at any rate, that's the series of show topics for the next four shows, ultimate survival in both man-made and natural catastrophes. There are many good survival web pages and books, etc., on the internet. I was at a conference in Colorado. One of my videos has a very good clip of a survivalist talking. That was done. That's the Global Wings conference, the workshop. There's a very good. Phil did a very great job of giving us some survivalist information. And it's included in that video. So once again, that's the Global Wings workshop video, which is on my webpage. But I want to talk about just some very simple preparation. So when many people think of survival, a lot of times they think, oh, I got to have all this stuff, and I have to have a bunker, and I have to have a cement shelter built in a hillside. And as I said, you may not even be near that when something comes down, when something big happens. So there are, and even if you're there, sometimes all of your preparations could be destroyed, etc. So what are the simple things you can do? What are the simple things that you have to do to keep going? And I've been working with friends. I'm not a survivalist myself. I'm a person who likes the comforts of home as much as anybody else. But it's very unusual. And what I found out is that the things that you would do to survive actually are very healthy things, things that you should be doing every day of the year, every day of your life. And that's what I found out. And that's what's very interesting, is because we have a terrible diet. We eat, we put all kinds of bad liquids in our bodies, everything from pop to fluorinated water and on. So, the issue of water I keep harping on, they're putting more and more things in your water. They now allow, bottled water to have fluorine in it. So you don't even know what you're drinking anymore. Whether it's in pop or bottled water, you think you're getting a nice fresh bottle of clean mountain spring water, and it just it's got fluorine in it, you know. So ultimately, you're going to be your only source of clean fresh water and fresh food. And this is the basics. If you get by that, you're going to be ahead of 99.9% of all the rest of the people on the planet. And it's very simple, and as I said, once you learn how to do this, you're going to want to do it every day because it's actually very healthy for you also. So I'll get into that later in the show. So have a paper and pen handy so you can take some notes, and of course the archives are always there. For people on the shortwave, listening on shortwave around the world, that don't have access to internet, I would suggest find somebody, or no matter where you are in the world, you can access my archives of my radio shows via the internet. So I would suggest, once again, I'll quick give those dates. Of 2006, the issues of extrasolar system disasters, the psychology of Planet X. You really should listen to these shows. So they're of 2006, May 18th, May 25th, June 1st, and June 8th. That's this past year. And then last December, 2005, December 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th. In other words, the last four shows of 2005, dealing with the science of Planet X. The many Planet X objects, because there's not just one Planet X out there. So at any rate, first of all, a couple quick announcements. I will be on WCCO Radio, that's a large AM station out of Minneapolis, this coming Sunday night, December 10th, 2006, at 1 a.m. in the morning Central Daylight Time. That's 830 a.m. And this station covers the eastern 38 states of the United States. So if you're anywhere in the eastern U.S., you can pick this up with host Brad Walton. And I'll be on for a number of hours that night. Once again, Sunday, December 10th, early in the morning, 1 a.m. Central Standard Time, WCCO Radio. It's an AM station out of Minneapolis, 830 AM on your radio dial, once again covering 38 states in the eastern, anything east of the Rockies, people can pick that up. Okay, so now on to, let's see if there's any other topics here. I'm going to get right into the show tonight, and I'm going to start it off by talking about an announcement that came out this week from Cox News Agency, and then we posted it on CNN. This was a general NASA news release, so you probably saw this in many places. NASA claims it wants a permanent moon base by the year, they say, 2024. And what I find comical about this is that none of the people that are going to the meetings and flying around and making speeches, etc., about this, are even going to be employed by NASA. And in fact, most of them won't even be alive by 2024. So I find it rather comical that they are collecting a paycheck, going to these meetings and making these bizarre, futuristic announcements when there is absolutely no physical activity going on that would get NASA to the moon. And I want to refer back to the Gemini program, the pre-Apollo program, when Kennedy first said, let's go to the moon. NASA, at that time, which was a real shirt sleeve up to the elbow, let's get our hands dirty, let's build something, and it was run by engineers, not business executive CEOs and people who are interested in getting government money into their bank accounts. Back in the good old days of the Gemini program, people rolled up their sleeves and they had people going into orbit in the Gemini program, and they had a whole series of steps that they were going to take to ultimately go to the moon. And it was an amazing engineering program. Ultimately, of course, with a very bizarre ending during the Nixon years and with a very questionable effort of going to the moon. But that's not the point here. The point is that the reason I bring this up is because we are being kind of slid down the road that something is going to happen with this government space program, and it's nothing more than a facade, and nothing is going on. It's a smokescreen. And then I want to read this quote that actually comes from the EOS, it's the American Geophysical Weekly Newsletter, that it has articles on current events in the science world, etc. And this is talking about past millennia climate variability. And for those of you who have access to this, it's volume 87, number 47, the 21st of November issue. So at any rate, on page 527, it says, talking about past millennia climate variability. This is a quote. It says, particularly relevant in this context is the time frame of the past few millennia, which is termed the late Holocene. It goes on to say, during this period, the fundamental external boundary conditions on the climate, such as the configuration of the continents, the size and location of the major ice sheets, and the mean radiative forcing due to changes in Earth orbital geometry, are similar to those today. I want to read this again because it's kind of a mouthful, but basically what they're saying is the Earth's climate and the major factors, meaning continental design, the position of the continents, the location of major ice sheets, etc., has not changed. And so they're trying to talk about climate variability over a very long period of time through this entire past possibly 10,000 years and saying that the Earth has been just the same as it is now. That's coming from standard science. And, of course, you don't believe that, and I don't believe that, but that's what is being fed to the public through the standard news media, etc. Let me go to, let's see, I have a series of readings I'm going to give you, but let's go back to something called the Exodus. And that's a term when many of my ancestors, now there's been a lot of distortion in history regarding the Exodus and who people are, races of people, but what actually happened was the precursors to the Anglo races were in bondage in Egypt. This was sometimes called the Babylonian captivity. And there was a time when these people, there was a natural catastrophe, and we've all read about that. We've heard about Moses. And these people left under extremely dire conditions. And this is something, and I want you to remember this because this will come up towards the end of the show. When they left, when the Israelites left, and now there's been a great calamitous change in the name, in the use of the name Israel in the country right now in the Mideast. But be that as it may, the real Israelites were the ones that fled out of Egypt during the Exodus. And much the precursors, they ended up, many of them, in Europe, and many of them eventually going to the British Isles, and many of them as far as Scandinavia, through Europe, etc. And my particular ancestors came from there and were living in Ireland. My ancestors come from that stock of people. More particularly, my ancestors come from the Scandinavian groups that came down and then populated northern and the western bays of Ireland. So at any rate, be that as it may, I have somewhat of a kinship to this whole story. But the point is, and this is what I want you to remember, as I said towards the end of the show, this will come back and weave into the narration of tonight's show. They left Egypt with nothing but unleavened bread. That's the very very specific verse that stuck in my mind as a kid and still sticks in my mind today. That when the final call came to leave, and this is after the painting of the blood over the doorway and the death and destruction. And remember that many people died in this. This was the initial visitation of the large comet Venus passing by Earth, and I'll talk more about Velikovsky during this show and the upcoming three shows. I'll talk about the Colbran, which relives this entire event. I'll talk about other studies that I've done. But when it comes right down to it, and this show is about ultimate survival, and that's what these people were all about. When they went running out into the desert from Egypt, all they took with them was a loaf of unleavened bread. They grabbed what they could, and interestingly enough, this was related to wheat. And that's something that is a key, and that will weave back into this story over and over again. And of course, they didn't have water filters back then. They didn't have a way to purify water, but there are natural ways to do that, and I'm going to talk about that. Today we have the benefit of scientifically advanced water filter systems, but the two things you're going to need are fresh water and some form of food, and this is what I'm going to talk about tonight. Ultimately, and just remember that when the Israelites fled Egypt after the Babylonian captivity during the Exodus, the one thing they all grabbed and ran out with was their loaf of bread that was laying on the counter. And you can bet there were some bags of wheat that went along with that, because that was the only thing they were going to have to eat as they went out into the unknown. So with that in mind, I'm going to read a few passages here from Velikovsky. Now, this is from Worlds in Collision, and this is a book that everybody should read. And once again, I always advise people that if you are interested in Velikovsky, don't go to websites that pretend to be Velikovsky interpreters or whatever you might want to call them. Read Velikovsky's books. Read what Velikovsky said, and then you will understand Velikovsky. Understand that in the 50s, when he was publishing these books, such as Worlds in Collision, Ages in Chaos, and Earth in Upheaval, when he was publishing these books, he didn't have the science available to him that we have today. So anyway, with that in mind, he did a tremendous amount of research into the Earth conditions. And I want to just quickly refer back to NASA claiming it's going to go to the moon. That's the smokescreen. That's what I started out with. Then I want to refer to, once again, the standard scientific community, which says that there has that the Earth has been just like it is now. The continents, the glaciers, the major ice sheets, the orbital position of the Earth, everything was the same, they say. Huh. Well, let's see what the reality is. And now here, I'm going to read from Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision, and this is dealing with ice. Okay, he's talking about Greenland. It's a subchapter called Greenland. Greenland is the contemporary example. I'm reading from the book now. Greenland is the contemporary example of what, according to the Ice Age theory, happened to a large part of the world in times past. Greenland belongs to the great archipelago that crowns northeastern Canada, though it is sometimes regarded as part of Europe. It is the largest island in the world if we consider Antarctica and Australia as continents. It's 1,660 miles long, largely within the Arctic Circle, reaching the northern latitude of 83 degrees. Of its 840,000 square miles of surface, over 700,000 are covered with an immense mountain of ice that leaves free only the coastal fringes. The thickness of the ice is measured by listening to the echo that comes back from the bedrock when a detonation is set off the top of the ice. It is found to be over 6,000 feet thick. For a long time, it was a belief of many that a large region of the interior of Greenland was free from ice and was perhaps inhabited. It was in part to solve this problem, and I just want to interject this here. What he's talking about is there were rivers of fresh water flowing out from central Greenland. And so what they thought is, well, the ice is just around the outside. This is back in the 1800s. They just thought the ice was around the outside, and there must be this tremendously green, lush area in the middle of Greenland because of all of the fresh water flowing out of it. So at any rate, back to reading Velikovsky, he says, it was in part to solve this problem that Baron Nordenskjold set out upon his expedition of 1883. He ascended the ice cap from Disko Bay, latitude 69 degrees, and went eastward for 18 days across the ice field. Rivers were flowing in channels upon the surface like those cut in land, only that the pure blue of the ice walls was by comparison infinitely more beautiful. These rivers were not, however, perfectly continuous. After flowing for a distance in the channels on the surface, they one and all plunged with deafening roar into some yawning crevice to find their way to the sea through subglacial channels. Numerous lakes with shores of ice were also encountered. And so he goes on talking about the ice sheet and the water coming out of the center of the island. This Arctic island reveals how vast continental areas looked in the past. However, it does not explain how ice could have covered British Guiana and Madagascar in the tropics. And what is no less surprising, the northern part of Greenland, according to the concerted opinion of glaciologists, was never glaciated. Probably then, as now, an exception was the northernmost part of Greenland, for it seems a rule that the most northerly lands are not and never were glaciated, writes a popular explorer. The islands of the Arctic Archipelago, writes another scientist, were never glaciated, neither was the interior of Alaska. It is a remarkable fact that no ice mass covered the lowlands of northern Siberia any more than those of Alaska. Okay, so I'm going to go on. That's one part. Next section says is talking about corals of the polar regions. Spitsbergen, this is the name of an explorer, in the Arctic Ocean, this is the town. Spitsbergen in the Arctic Ocean is as far north from Oslo in Norway as Oslo is from Naples. Hare, the explorer, identified 136 species of fossil plants in Spitsbergen, 78 degrees north latitude, which he ascribed to the Tertiary Age. Among the plants were pines, firs, spruces, cypresses, also elms, hazels, and water lilies. At the northernmost tip of Spitsbergen, a bed of black and lustrous coal 20 feet to 30 feet thick was found. It is covered with black shale and sandstone encrustalized in fossilized land plants. When we remember that this vegetation grew luxuriantly within 8 degrees of the North Pole in a region which is in darkness for half of the year and is now almost continuously buried under snow and ice, we can realize the difficulty of the problem in the distribution of climate which these facts present to the geologist. Okay, and that goes on. Now I want to read one last quick passage, once again from Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision. It's talking about whales in the mountains. In bogs covering glacial deposits in Michigan, skeletons of two whales were discovered. Whales are marine animals. How did they come to Michigan in the post-glacial epoch? Whales do not travel by land. Glaciers do not carry whales, and the ice sheet would not have brought them to the middle of a continent. Besides, the whale bones were found in post-glacial deposits. Was there a sea in Michigan after the glacial epoch, only a few thousand years ago? Okay, so anyway, that's some reading from Velikovsky. I'm going to go on to a passage. Now, this is from my weather book, Principia Meteorologia, page 270. And it's an article I wrote in 1982, just after I was at Cornell University. And I reproduced this in the weather book in one of the appendices exactly as it was written in the original form. The title of the article was From Exodus to Voyager 2, The Velikovsky Connection. And this, as I said, I wrote in 1982. Talking and explaining Velikovsky's work with my comet theoretical work. Okay, so I'll read from, once again, this is From Exodus to Voyager 2, The Velikovsky Connection. Darkness engulfed a land of poisoned water and fiery rains. Reddish-blue fingers of auroral death performed satanic dance among the clouds. The decimated slave nation sealed their doors, covered chimneys, and prayed their god to avenge 200 years of Egyptian bondage. Desperate to end the plagues wrought over his empire, Pharaoh searched the alleys for the slave prophet Moses to deliver his surrender. Go, take your people, all is in ruin. Fleeing into the wasteland, the multitude packed only the next day's bread. The air reeked of ozone as they reached the Red Sea. Pillars of swirling electrical smoke plumed skyward. Deafening strokes of cosmic lightning thundered like marching hooves along the Sinai. And now, besieged by armies from behind with a raging comet in their path, A doomed nation's cries awakened as a miraculous wall of water arose to devour the Sphinx's pride. The waters were moved, and the throngs escaped over what was once the sea bottom. Studying at Columbia University in 1946, Emanuel Velikovsky began to unravel the tales of destruction handed down from cultures of ancient lands. His goal was to search for and hopefully establish a single worldwide event, and it goes on. So that's from my weather book, the last appendix in the book, and I'm going to read just a quick passage from the Colbran. The Colbran is a book handed down from ancient times and passed through a group called the Chaldeans. And if you want a copy of the Colbran, you can go to their website, www.chaldeantrust.org. That's C-U-L-D-I-A-N trust, T-R-U-S-T, .org. And don't be fooled by the imitation Colbran that somebody is trying to pawn off on the internet, because it is literally a bootleg issue. And if you do have that one, send it back, because it is not the Colbran. I don't know what you would call it, but it is not the Colbran. But at any rate, reading from the true Colbran, once again, if you want a copy of the Colbran, it's a beautiful large book with a gold embossed symbol, Celtic symbol on the front. It's called the Colbran, K-O-L-B-R-I-N, and you can get a copy from www.chaldeantrust.org, C-U-L-D-I-A-N-T-R-U-S-T.org. So now reading from Chapter 3, and I've talked about this many times on my show before. At the time of the great destruction of Earth, God caused a dragon from out of heaven to come down and encompass her about. The dragon was frightful to behold, and of course they're talking about a large comet here. Making a note here. The dragon was frightful to behold. It lashed its tail, it breathed out fire and hot coals, and a great catastrophe was inflicted upon mankind. The body of the dragon was wreathed in a cold, bright light, and beneath, on the belly, was a ruddy hued glow, while behind it trailed a flowing trail of smoke. It spewed out cinders and hot stones, and its breath was foul and stenchful, poisoning the nostrils of men. Its passage caused great thunderings and lightnings to rend the thick, darkened sky. All of heaven and earth were made hot. The seas were loosened from their cradles and rose up, pouring across the land. There was an awful shrilling trumpeting, which outpowered even the howling of the unleashed winds. So that's the last of the readings that I'm going to read on this show. And then I'm going to go into how these people survived. How did they overcome this amazing destruction and, in fact, survive and prosper in the years to come? And what's very clear from Velikovsky is that for hundreds of years after this destruction, man survived. But it was during this ultimate catastrophe, when Earth was brought asunder, that people found a way to get through on a day-by-day basis and to survive and to make it through to the other side, where they could start building a society, so that a number of thousands of years later, here we are populating the Earth once again. And if you look, now this is something I did in my astronomy classes. I taught university-level astronomy for a number of years, and I would, every class, sometimes students would come in and they would be somewhat bored, and you could tell, well, I got to do something here, and I had this little project, mental project, that I pulled out of my hip pocket. And I took them back in time, and it was a very subtle way I did this. I said, okay, we're gonna talk about history today. And the first thing I want you to do is look back and look around you and tell me something that was not here a week ago. And somebody might say, well, there's a new sign down the street for the shopping center. They just put up a new sign, and that wasn't there a week ago. I say, okay, good. How about a month ago? What wasn't here? And somebody might say, well, you know, there's a housing development, and I'm seeing new houses there that were not even there a month ago. And I'd say, okay, well, let's go back a year. What wasn't here? And somebody said, well, I had a new birth in the family, and so the baby wasn't there before. I said, okay, that's great. And so we'd go back 5 years, what wasn't here, 10 years, what wasn't here. And what I was doing was programming the students' minds, and they didn't quite know where I was going with this. But then we'd go back 10 years, we'd go back 20 years, excuse me, and we'd go back 50 years, 100 years. And, of course, going back 100 years, people said, well, gee, you know, 100 years ago, most of the western part of the United States had no white man in it at all. It was the Native Americans who lived there and lived there as they were, you know, throughout times past without interference from the Europeans who were coming over in great waves. I said, what about 200 years ago? What about 500 years ago? And so then we started talking about natural resources, forests that were here. The great European forests were still there. You know, the Middle Ages, the people were just starting to build the Renaissance and become aware of themselves and who they are, etc. And so the point was that now I started going back 1,000 years. And then that's when the students started to realize that we had many diverse populations. We had the Chinese, the Tibetans. We had, we could go back prior to Marco Polo making the first connection over land to the east, or Vasco da Gama or some of the great ocean explorers making the first connection to the east or other parts, or the Norway explorers coming to the northern North American continent and settling there, or Columbus coming to the Antilles Islands and making the first discovery that the Western Hemisphere was even here and there were great populations of indigenous people here, and on and on. And now what these students were doing and what you're doing as I'm going back in time, let's go back 4,000 years to what we call the dawn of history, where we really don't have much history back then. And let's look at the condition, the physical condition of the earth. And what you find are population centers all around the world that are very diverse. You have the pre-Inca in South America. You have the pre-Coco cultures in southern Mexico in Central America. You have the Chinese, which actually had somewhat of a developed culture back then. The Tibetans, which go way back and have written culture. You have, there's this myth that somehow man came across the Bering Strait and populated the Western Hemisphere, but you find that that is absolutely ludicrous when you find that the cities being discovered in South America now go back prior to the Egyptian pyramids. So, interestingly enough, what the students came to realize, and it was always at this point that some of the students started to get angry. They got angry because they realized that every piece of historical information that they were fed about who they were and where they came from, everything that their education up to their college years had told them, was a piece of garbage. It could not possibly be true, the history of the world that they had been fed. They started to get angry. So this is getting towards the end of the class, and I said, okay, I want your assignment for tonight is to go to the library. Go to the library and research and find out what is the true story about where you came from and the true history of the world. And they would go out of the class, and they were talking, and they were angry, and they were frustrated. And they came back the next day, and they were even more angry and more frustrated. They said, there's nothing in the library that says anything about who we are or where we came from that's anywhere close to possibly being true. And I said, that's right. And that's the way it is with science, and that's the way it is with geology and biology and evolutionary biology. I said, everything you have been taught is wrong. I didn't have to tell them that. They had figured it out for themselves. And they would look at me in dead silence. For that was an awakening period for these people. And now what I'm going to do in addition here with the show tonight is I'm going to talk about how these early peoples survived. And they went through a great catastrophe. The earth went through a great catastrophe, and it's one of the greatest things that has been held from the population. And your true history, if you really knew what it was, you would learn what survivors, your ancestors, were. One of the greatest methods of controlling a population is to erase their history. And this has skillfully been done over hundreds, if not thousands, of years to erase now your history, your true history. Now, a book like the Colbran was kept in trust for thousands of years. It was passed on, and there were many attempts to destroy it. The Roman armies were sent to Glasgow, England, in the early days to try and destroy the Colbran, and it got out, some of it in pieces. They burnt and destroyed that area, but for a long time, that area of England was impenetrable by the Roman army. It was called the area where the army cannot go. That's a very interesting quote from a friend of mine, Pastor Peters, who talks about that on his radio show. And he said that the Roman armies literally had a name for that part of England. It was the area where the Roman army could not go. And so, ultimately, they sent a large army, and the Chaldeans, however, were able to escape with the Colbran. And the Colbran is not one book. The way we see it today is a collection of books compiled into one, bits and pieces of old texts, etc. But the Colbran was originally as a name that came about in recent years. But the original information was in a vast library that was funded and placed there by a guy named Joseph of Arimathea. He was the uncle of Christ. And after the problems in Rome, they moved everything back to England, where Joseph of Arimathea had spent much time. In his previous years, he was a businessman, and he did a lot of business in England back then, back in the old Roman days. But at any rate, the point is, the survival of this information, it has survived many onslaughts, and it's now coming down to you. Through people who, when I was first given the Colbran, for example, many years ago, it was one of the first copies to come into the United States. It was one of the first three copies. And that the people who were harboring this for that long time had heard me on the radio, and they said, this guy could tell us what this book really means. So I got the Colbran and started reading it and feeding back information to the Chaldeans, and telling them what the book really meant in terms of history, in terms of science, in terms of the comet disasters that occurred thousands of years ago. And the books in the Chaldean ownership were harbored and kept for thousands of years. And finally, I was able to explain to them what it really meant in terms of science, in terms of historical actual events. But it was not long after that the people who don't want this information going to the public sought to destroy the Colbran. And thus you see the imitation, the phony Colbrans that float around the internet. If you have a Colbran that has an orange planet-looking thing on the cover, send it back to wherever you got it, because it's a fake, it's an imitation, and it's meant to distort the true message of the Colbran. Go to the real source, as I said, chaldeantrust.org, and get a real Colbran, and you'll be very glad you did. You'll be able to read also about the devastation that occurred back in the old days. But now I'm going to get to the heart of this show. how did these people survive? When the other shoe dropped, as they say, when the ultimate catastrophe was right facing them in the face, when they had no place to turn but themselves, how did they survive? And the two things that they needed were food and fresh water. And ultimately, you're possibly going to be faced with the same situation someday. There are many other things that you may need. In fact, I've identified one of them in my pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage. And one of these days on this show, I'm going to talk about this specifically and have a little class on this. In the middle of that book, it shows you how to build a calendar out of a pile of rocks, because one of the first things you're going to lose in any catastrophe is time. Time, dates, when is the planting season, when is the harvest season, etc. And without those dates, it's going to be impossible to survive. So, excuse me. At any rate, let's get back to survival. And this is what I found, and this is what I was talking about early in the show, that the ultimate survival things that you need are things that you should be doing every day. And go back to the Exodus. What did they grab? They grabbed the day's bread and ran out into the desert. And you better believe that along with that day's bread were some bags of wheat. Now, this is what I think is very important, because wheat seed can be eaten in many ways. It keeps, the wheat shell is extremely impenetrable. It's extremely hard, and it contains, you can find wheat seeds. In fact, I believe they did this. They found some in the pyramids, the Egyptian pyramids, which were thousands of years old, and they still grew. There are casks of grasses and seeds that were found in the American Southwest, and they were able to cultivate these seeds. There are brands of corn that were stored and were found thousands of years old, and they were able to germinate the seeds. So these grains are extremely important. They're easy to carry. And let's take some numbers here. I know a lot of people are not farmers, and they probably aren't aware of this. But, and I'll talk about a few issues here. Sprouting seeds is one of the most basic and nutritious forms of food. The enzymes, this is one of the best forms of live food that you can eat. In fact, people who have gone on a strictly sprout diet have become very healthy. In fact, people who have been very sick. This is actually a purging technique that I've heard has been used in some centers where they take people who are very sick and ill, and they want to clean out their system. They actually feed them two or three times a day excessive amounts of juice that comes from sprouts. And what this does is it goes into your system and it replaces the bad stuff and brings in good stuff. Let's just put it that way. So for basic survival, and this is the point, I'm going to come back to this, and then I'm going to expand on the things that you would need. Like, let's say that you just had something you could carry under your arm. You got your kid in one hand, you got something that you can carry under your arm in the other hand. What would be under that other hand? What would you carry with you? And the answer is, you would take a water filter and a bag of wheat grain, whole grain, unground whole grain. And this is available. I myself do not sell the whole grain. It's available from very good sources. It's organic. And you can also go to just the feed store, get oats, corn, whole corn, field corn, etc., and that will grow. You can sprout it and eat it, and a 40-pound bag will last you a long time. You can also get organic, which costs a little bit more, and it doesn't have all of the chemicals in it. But in a survival scenario, having a large bag of wheat, this is your ultimate survival kit. And it's very simple. It's something you can pick up and carry with you. And even if you're in darkness, say you were in a place where there was no sunlight for a long time, the sprouts will grow without sunlight. It's always good to have a little bit of light to green them up, but they will actually sprout, and they'll be white, kind of a whitish color when they sprout. But still, and then what people do today, of course, the modern way of doing this is juicing them, so you have a little hand crank or electric juicer, and you put the grass seed through there, the sprouts, and juice it, and then drink the juice. But your teeth and your jaw are the old-fashioned juicer. You just chew on it and spit out the heavy fiber, because you can't eat all of that fiber. Alfalfa sprouts and mung sprouts, those kind of sprouts, you can't eat the fiber because there's not that much fiber in it. But if you're dealing with wheat fiber, there's a great deal of fiber, and you cannot eat all of that fiber, but you can just put the sprouts in your mouth, chew them. And now the modern way of growing sprouts is on a shallow tray with dirt. But I'll tell you something, what I've found, and I have friends that are now experimenting with this, is that if you have mineralized water, in other words, you have water that has the mineral content in it, you don't need any dirt at all. So here's my basic survival kit that I would recommend everybody have. A water filter, which basically the top part, this is a gravity feed water filter, and those I sell on my webpage for a very good reason. So they're available to you so that you have a source of fresh, clean water. And it's the most important thing you can have in your life. In a day of survival, in a day when you have to stay within your home or someplace else for a period of time and you need fresh water, you are going to be your only source of fresh, clean water. And a 25-pound or 100-pound bag, whatever you can muster up, of wheat grass. Now, there are places that sell, it's a winter red wheat is the best wheat for sprouting and for juicing. Winter red wheat has the best, it's sometimes called Durum wheat, but it is the healthiest, this is the staff of life. And I remember a person, and I don't remember where I heard this story, I wish I could reference where I heard it, but a person's relative came over from Germany, and she said, I want to go to the store and get some bread. So they took her to the store, and there were racks and racks of all of this processed white bread that were on the shelf. And she went, and in Germany they call it the bread of life is the name of it. And she's looking through, and she's feeling these soft, you know, almost mushy bags of what we call bread. And she goes, this is not the bread of life. I don't know what this is, but you don't have any here. This is not bread. And she was very angry that she could not find bread here. But the real bread was made from freshly ground wheat. And it is said that after you grind the wheat, the little berry, as it's called, after you grind it, within minutes, it starts to lose its potency and many of the enzymes and other nutrients that are in it. So that's why sprouting is very good. Now, here's another thing I found about sprouts. You could take sprouts, put them in a container or in a plastic bag, and with a little bit of moisture, and they will keep for days, sometimes weeks. And then you can bring them out and actually grow them or plant them. Now, if you were in a scenario where you could grow wheat, this is what I was going to talk about, agriculture, a 40-pound bag of wheat is enough to plant an entire acre of land and then harvest that the next season, and you would have a continuous supply of wheat. If you're just sprouting it, you with a little bit of dirt or in a window box, you could also produce your own seeds. And this is something that people should start to experiment with. Growing some, leaving it grow all the way to seed. Now, if you take a plate, and I'm going to explain this because I've been doing it myself and I know other people that are starting to do it, take six plates, like ceramic plates or metal plates or stainless steel or aluminum plates, whatever you have, and a quart jar. Here's how you do it. You take some fresh filtered water. You put in a half a cup of the wheat seeds. Like I say, it's a red winter wheat seed. And you let them soak in the quart jar for, let's say a day. Then you drain that water off and you pour the seeds on one of your plates. Then you put a half a cup of seeds into your quart jar, pour fresh water into that, let those soak for a day, and the next day you pour those on the second plate. You do that the third day, and this is a system that you do every day. In 6 days, your first plate will be ready to harvest and eat, chew, juice, whatever you want to do with it. And what happens is you don't need any dirt. The good thing about the Berkey filter is it leaves the minerals in the water. It takes out the bad stuff and leaves in the minerals, which you need to grow your wheatgrass. And with this system, by putting a half a cup of wheat in that jar and starting it, and one day when you harvest and eat the wheat off of one plate, you then begin, you rinse that off, clean that plate off, and start that plate over again. You will have a continuous supply of food enough for 6 people to eat. And you'll be surprised at the amount, and this is the key to not using dirt, is that you use the roots and everything. The roots become a massive bound, kind of like a big patty, and then the blades of grass are growing up out of this. Now, this is extremely important. This is your ultimate survival kit. If you had something to carry with you and there was a disaster, and as I said, you got your kid in one hand and you got something you can carry under your other arm, what I would want under my other arm is my water filter and 25 pounds of winter red Durham wheat seed, the berries they call them. And that's what I would take with me if that's all I could carry. I would probably like to take a small knife, too, because that's always handy for cutting or cutting plants or other kinds of... I would take a small saw if I had one of those fold-up saws, and I would take a small shovel. If I could carry that much, I would take that. But in a lot of cases, you find in ancient history, as with the Exodus, they only had time and room to pack that day's bread. And as I said, I bet you a lot that there were some bags of wheat that went along with them to get them through those first few days. And of course, one of the issues with the Exodus too was the manna. As the big comet came by, there was a tremendous amount of rain. There was movement of the earth. The glaciers were forming. The North Pole shifted by about 30 to 35 degrees. Everything you hear from standard science is wrong, which is amazing. Right now, I am out of time. I'm going to close out this show, and I'll be back next week to talk about more. Once again, this is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.